Welcome to the Talking Poem Podcast. I'm your host, Charlie Green. Sometimes I produce short episodes where it's just me, and on episodes like today's, I invite a guest to bring in any poem they'd like to talk about for any reason. We'll follow the poem and the conversation wherever they go, and after that, we'll have a little silliness. If you enjoy the show, please follow and rate it wherever you get your podcasts. Today, I am absolutely stoked to have as my guest, comedian, writer, and pal, not mine specifically, but generally a pal, Josh Gondelman. He was the head writer and a producer of Desus and Miro, a staff writer on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, a writer for Billy on the Street. I have to compress your bio quite a bit. He's also appeared on various late night shows. Wait, don't tell me on NPR. And he has a fantastic Substack. Most importantly, he's in my personal pantheon of great podcast guests, particularly on The Bugle and when he's on All Fantasy Everything. Josh, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. What a generous introduction.
So you're the first guest I've had on who has like no connection to poetry, either through writing or through a job. I just had like, I had a feeling that you would have a poem or poems. So I'm just curious to hear you talk about like your relationship to poetry.
It's really case by case with poems, poems and horror movies, where it's like not my genre, but when you catch me with one that hits me, it really hits me.
Where do you find poems or where do they come to you?
So the one we're going to talk about has like a very specific genesis in my life, but I also like am friends with a lot of writers and friends with a lot of people who write poetry and who live, you know, swim in that water more. So I see stuff that they're sharing on social media. Gosh, I think the last couple poems that really stuck with me, my wife Maris, who is a writer and book critic and podcaster, and she has a great newsletter as well. We co-emceed the reading the night before the National Book Awards a few years ago. And so I heard some like really moving poetry readings there, like Jericho Brown, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Was great. And Ilya Kaminsky read that that poem that became that it's like now a and maybe it was then, but as a famous poem, I think that we lived happily during the war, which is like his reading of it was really haunting and affecting.
That's awesome. Yeah. That poem is, there's like a circle of poems that get shared a lot. And that's one of them.
Yeah. The Maggie Smith Good Bones is one that I feel like is it's like a poem that is a viral poem, you know, which is so funny. And that it just Maris just shared this again on social media, that to the woman in the stall next to me, is it
Kim Adnizio, previous podcast guest.
That's like one of those that you see a lot, which I think is like kind of cool. Mm-hmm. That like it is a piece of literature that is discreet enough that it can like have its own life outside the context of a book, because it's like more than a quote, right? But like, but less than a complete published body of work. And so it's fun and like, it's like a very special unit of literature that it can have that kind of life, a poem.
Sometimes it becomes kind of like advertising. Like there's the Mary Oliver poem, Wild Geese, that ends, "What will you do with your one wild and precious life?" And on a previous episode, my friend Will said, yeah, when I was in a hospital for rehab, like that quote was everywhere. So it's kind of like, so. Well, so you brought in Edna St. Vincent Millay's poem, God's World, and I'll just ask you to go ahead and read it, and then we'll talk about it.
Sure. Okay, here we go. God's World by Edna St. Vincent Millay. O world, I cannot hold thee close enough. Thy winds, thy wide gray skies, thy mists that roll and rise, thy woods this autumn day that ache and sag and all but cry with color, that gaunt crag to crush, to lift the lean of that black bluff. World, world, I cannot get thee close enough. Long have I known a glory in it all, but never knew I this. Here such a passion is as stretcheth me apart. Lord, I do fear, thou'st made the world too beautiful this year. My soul is all but out of me. Let fall no burning leaf. Prithee, let no bird call.
Thank you so much. So why'd you choose this poem?
So this is a poem that has stuck with me for a long time. I grew up going to a synagogue near where I lived in the suburbs of Boston. And we had when you're a kid, there were like children's services for the high holidays, for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And instead of like a full High Holiday prayer book. We had this like Xeroxed 20-page children's service pamphlet. And so every year we would go through this pamphlet. So it was like very ingrained in me through routine. And then for a couple of years, I led the children's services for the younger kids. So this poem, it wasn't all, you know, it was some traditional Hebrew prayers, some traditional Jewish readings. But this poem was part of the packet that was like the children's High Holiday services. And so it was like, it like really resonated with me in a way that sometimes I think scripture doesn't hit when you're a kid.
Yeah.
You know, like the scripture itself feels maybe a little less accessible. But this idea of like the fall, right? So it felt relevant to, and the idea of God or a higher power being a force in the universe felt very, just the idea of its fall. And I just can't stand how beautiful nature is. Like, I'm going to tear myself in half if I see a leaf fall. Is like such a beautiful aspirational way to like look at the world, in my opinion.
I think that's really cool. And I think that one of the reasons I like this poem, because there's kind of a genre of, oh, the world is so beautiful,
yeah,
kind of poems. But this one, it's so beautiful, it hurts. And it's not even like a particularly idealistic or idealized landscape.
You know,
it's like wide gray skies, mists, the woods in autumn that ache and sag.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's surprising to me that it was part of the scripture or part of the service, but it kind of makes sense because a lot of religious texts have this, you have to find the hope in this.
Yeah.
Downtime.
And there's like so much beauty in the mundane. And it's like, I just love the idea of like, I'm going to like, my eyes are going to bug out of my head like a cartoon wolf if I hear a bird. I swear to God, I'm going to lose my mind if I see a leaf. And it's like, I just think that that's like horniness for like all of nature is so, there's like such a purity to it. And it felt like, I also think that there's just so much in it. Like the rhymes feel they're very clear, but like because of the way, the line breaks, like if you see it, you go, oh, enough, and then skies and rise and sag and crag and bluff and enough rhyme. But like the way that the sentences end and like continue, the rhymes don't like beat you over the head because you're really like ending thoughts in the middle of a line. Is that enjambment? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, ding, ding, ding. This is not part of the game later, but yeah.
Oh, sick. But that is like I think that makes it feel a little more, there's a little less like artifice. Like it's so interesting because you see how clearly constructed it is with where the line breaks are and where the rhymes hit. But when you read it, it's not like, there once was a man from Nantucket. And you're like, you know what I mean? Like it doesn't hit you. Roses are red, violets are blue. Like there's a subtlety to the way it reads.
Yeah, I agree completely. She is, all her poems have this, like they're very musical, and but the musicality isn't sing-songy. Like she has such a good ear, and when she needs to have that emphasis, she does. Like the first stanza, to lift the lean of that black bluff, world, world, I cannot get thee close enough. And you kind of feel the emphasis there because all that enjambment builds up, and then we get this hard hit with the rhyme there.
But I love like the end, right? My soul is all but out of me. Let fall no burning leaf, prithee, let no bird call. Where there is that hard fall call rhyme, but it's like, let fall no burning leaf. And so you get the rhyme, but you also get this like very more naturalistic way of expression that you like, so that even though there is the rhyme and this like very clear crystalline poetic structure, you also, you're just like, oh, this is how a person might express this thought were they not sitting down with a pen to, you know, to like structure a poem.
Her sonnets especially, and this is a sonnet, although kind of a weird one, are always like that, where she has that kind of, she has this kind of incredible ear for rhythm, for when to break lines. Like the first lines and, you know, close enough, gray skies and rise, but like the not picking up the rhyme with enough until later helps it avoid that sing-songiness. And so
I don't know, it just has like really stuck with me for a really long time. And I don't, like you mentioned earlier, there's lots of poems about like, oh, trees are pretty, or like, oh, it's spring and there's flowers. But that, like this one, I don't know why, but maybe it's just like when it came into my life and the repetition that was kind of drilled into me through like their religious ritual repetition that made it sick. But it's like, I don't know, lots of other stuff from the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur didn't stick in the way this did. So it's like, it's a real combination of factors that have just like, it just like rattles around in my head.
Were the services otherwise like in Hebrew or English? Or
it was it a mix? It was a little of both. The children's service was more English to like, because it was, I think I probably started going when I was like seven. Like as soon as you're big enough that your parents can stay downstairs at the real service, or that they'll stay with you up at the kids' service. So like it started out very young, and then I went to the service up through my like probably mid-teens because I was leading the services for the small kids. So like it was a pretty wide swath of my childhood, but a lot of English, because I you know, there were prayers that have very, you know, touchstone prayers in Hebrew that there's rhythm and song to it in Hebrew and no real English equivalent, but it was a lot of like little readings. Like I think in my memory, there was also like very early on a reading by a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., like a very short quote. And so it was a lot of trying to, I think, connect like the themes of the Jewish religion to both the English language and like a more modern context.
That makes total sense. So probably I'm guessing like a modern Judaism, not obviously not Orthodox or conservative.
No, I mean, we were, but it was when I was there, a conservative synagogue. And I think has since become, it's reoriented a little bit. I don't know if it's Reform or Reconstructionist, but it was like the real adult services, like it's like, ooh, there's porno. But the Friday night and Saturday morning services, even when kids were studying for bar mitzvahs and, you know, I had to go all year, every Friday, every Saturday, they told you could only miss like two, I think, in the whole year. And those were like very traditional, like definitely some English readings or a lot of English readings, but like very rooted in the Hebrew. And the services on Saturday, Friday night was a little over an hour, probably. Saturday was like 2.5 hours. So this was not like,
oh God,
like get you in, get you out, drizzle a little faith on you. This is like real deal conservative, you know, the long aliyahs and the standing in the sitting.
Well, it makes even more sense then that for me that this poem would stick out, because it's like a prayer in its way. It's just such a different kind of prayer, you know.
It's I mean it's not, and I'm not sorry I interrupted you.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say I'm not an especially religious person, an observer. Like I feel a strong connection to Judaism, but not necessarily through prayer, but like this, I don't know. And so like the fact that it's called God's world does not seem like it would be up my alley exactly, but it's like such a nebulous concept of God in this, right? Like it's just kind of like, whoever put that tree there, great work.
Yeah, it's like she never addresses God directly. It's all, oh, world. And I'm not really religious at all, but there are a lot of lyric poems like this that have the kind of intensity of prayer that carries over for me in a way, you know, religion never quite did.
There's like a fervor to it, right? Like that you get that how someone would like be moved to speak in tongues or something. Like just like you get that emotional intensity and to like put the name of God in there, right? Like whoever invented fog, holy shit, you really, like, wow.
That dying tree. Oh, my God, it's incredible.
Gee, whoa.
Yeah, and you're killing
like,
that
I love
thing.
That, yeah.
Yeah, it's that's kind of the thing. I mean, she's always, there's this kind of wry humor in her poems, or always this kind of odd turn, and the fact that it's, here's the beauty in this, you know, ache and sag, that gaunt crag. Like there, the music is so great because it captures that feeling of kind of awfulness. She's like Gerard Manley Hopkins to me. I don't know if you've read much.
No.
He was a Jesuit priest in the late 19th century English, wrote a lot of poems, some of which are kind of inscrutable, but it's kind of okay. The music of them is so amazing that a lot of the times, even if you can't make sense of them, they're just really fantastic. And she has that, the way she hits sound like that, not to the intensity of him. Like, he really, at times, for some people, it's over the top. And for me, it's just like, keep doing this.
Cool.
This is kind of a weird sidestep, because I think about this because I listen to a lot of comedy and watch, you know, a lot of comedy specials. Are you thinking of sound ever, like when you're making jokes or doing jokes on stage?
Yeah, totally. I think there's, especially because it's such an oral spoken medium, right? Like, how the words feel to say is important before even the sound hits, right? Like, there are just certain combinations of words that don't feel right to say, and not in like an inappropriate way of just like, oh, they're harder to pronounce, or they don't put the emphasis of the meaning is not where the emphasis of the sound is, if that makes sense. And so that it really is a lot like dumb poetry in that way. But I think about it all the time, and especially like talking about something like, do you put the rhyme and the line break versus the structure of the sentences themselves is such a comedy idea as well, right? Because you're like, do you say the funny part in the middle of the sentence and then get the laugh and then have to finish? Or do you do the kind of like reverse engineering work of making sure that the funny part is at the end, which is like a more traditional punchline, right? And then backing it out from there of like, how do I make this punchline the last thing that I say before I pause?
And I would imagine it's a mix, or I would guess it's a mix of, sometimes it's in the writing and sometimes it's in the performing, that you kind of figure that out.
Totally. And you know, when you see people read poetry that are like invested readers, that I think that really comes out there too, where you go, oh, that's how that's supposed to sound. And obviously you can dictate that to a reading audience to an extent with punctuation and line breaks and format and scansion and stuff, but like, there's only so much you can, there's an added dimension when you're performing it out loud. So it's definitely, you know, that like where you pause, you can see it like written out as maybe space between lines or like space within a line. Yeah. It's like a very, it is very close to poetry in a lot of ways, especially because you can say things in a way that you wouldn't say them conversationally. You know, you can like add, you can make a sentence more ornate or more abrupt than it would be, like on the kind of opposite ends of a spectrum, in a way that like is effective to communicate that doesn't sound naturalistic at all.
And her poems are like that old world. And apparently she gave readings a lot. She didn't like it. It made her very anxious, but apparently was an incredible reader.
And
seems like she was an incredible person. Ben just fell in love with her again and again and again. And she was, you know, she was very active politically, and the poems are rollicking and incredible. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about the poem before we transition to the silliness part?
No, I think this is it. It like really has been something that I found very moving since I was a child, and like reading it as an adult, I still kind of, it like taps in very easily to that kind of overwhelming feeling. And I never really searched out or sought out more of her work. Although like today I was like, oh, I should look up who this person is. But it like occurred to me kind of late, because, you know, you start reading something when you're 8 years old and you read it every year and you like it becomes part of the fabric of this tradition. And it occurred to me as like, oh, this, she wasn't even Jewish. like her, they're not a lot of Jews with saint in the name. But it felt so meaningful that to me it is like, I wonder who, I never really talked to like who put these prayer guides together, because it was like a pretty eclectic mix of quotes and poems and prayers, and I was like, good work, whoever that is.
Yeah,
at Temple Emmanuel in Wakefield.
Yeah, shout out to Temple Emmanuel.
Hell yeah.
It's funny because it's always, even, you know, I have degrees in English and it still kind of feels haphazard, you know, how and where you come across poems.
Totally.
Because there's not like a standard curriculum. You know, there are certain things that you hit, but it's always just kind of all over the place, which I always appreciate because you can find things without expecting to find them.
Yeah, so. it's cool. And it's like the kind of thing where you can stumble across and enjoy like a manageably sized amount of someone's work, whereas like it's hard to imagine coming across like one page of Ulysses, let's say, and be like, damn, even though I didn't read this whole book, I got this one meaningful thing out of it, you know, whereas you can with a poem, even if it's part of a collection, if you see it compiled somewhere else or shared independently or performed live somewhere as part of a reading, you can be like, oh, this is a meaningful thought, feeling, arrangement of thoughts and feelings and style, in a way that like you don't get that with prose necessarily, unless you dive into like at least a short story.
Yeah, absolutely. So usually I have an ad here, and they're not real ads. I don't have enough listeners, but instead, in honor of your regular guest appearances on the Bugle, I have a pun run.
Oh, please.
Yeah, so Andy's Altman, the host, for listeners, he sometimes strings together several minutes of puns. And, you know, intentionally, the hit rate is kind of scattershot.
Yeah.
Have you been present for one during a recording?
I have. I did a couple of the Bugle live shows I called in via Zoom. I did one in Cambridge and one in Edinburgh. And he had compiled a pun run for this tour that he did about, like, leaders and generals through history, and it's like really, I think ideally you want to hear Andy perform these to an audience, because like the ebb and flow of like being thrilled, being delighted, being repulsed by the pun, being like the eye roll, it is truly a master class in like writing and performance and like a push and pull with an audience.
Yeah, I've tried to emulate that here, so hopefully this won't be the worst 3 minutes of your life.
Please.
So, Buckingham Palace recently decided to have a party celebrating the history of British poetry. For their purposes, by the way, they included Ireland in their history, as they, you know, want to do. They want to colonize that history. The royal family aimed to put on an affair fit for classic writers. They had no interest in serving junk eats. John Keats. They served the most colonial of hors d'oeuvres, red charred kipperlings, along with the food. Guests were offered a wide range of activities. You could hear waiters saying, Alfredo, Lord, tennis, anyone? There were other celebrities there too. Jerry Seinfeld didn't show because the royal family is now too woke, but the actor who played George Costanza was there, Jason Alexander, along with his wife, Dana. Call me Jason Alex, he told everyone. He and his wife had both recently converted to Catholicism with a lot of access, so they were both embarrassed when someone spilled drinks near them. Jason Alexander stayed dry, but wine went all over Dana, Alex, and her Pope. There were, in fact, quite a few Americans there. One couple brought their own corgi, and they tried to fit in by putting on really bad British accents, and their pronunciations were horrible. Their corgi got away, and the wife cried, Jeffrey, choss her! The dog got... The dog got... I can't tell you how happy I am that you're actually laughing at these.
I'm having a good time here.
The dog got out onto the grounds and began digging a hole near a servant with bad grammar who was flipping a coin over and over. When Jeffrey arrived to his dog, the man flipped the coin into the hole that the dog had dug. Bad dog, Jeffrey shouted, and the servant with bad grammar replied, can't her bury tails? Back inside, J.K. Rowling was quite drunk and was berating a trans guest. Her understanding of transitioning was terrible. She thought it was a full body change, limbs and all. And she was tired of getting shouted down by the transgender guests. So she yelled, go ahead, shame us, heenie. Meanwhile, sorry, that was terrible.
Nope, that's all right.
Maybe the world's worst terrible shame us, heenie.
That is one of the longer walks, and I respect it.
You respect it like watching a man skydiving without a parachute, I think.
No, that's untrue.
Meanwhile, a poker game had broken out in the kitchen between the chefs whose work was done. People were going in and out, so people were leaving and joining the game. As one man sat down, one of the chefs playing poker said, deal in Thomas. But another man,
that's smooth.
All right. Another man said, that's, Thomas.
Look, you and Taylor Swift, right? Dropping big Dylan Thomas references.
Well, you know, we have a close acquaintanceship, me and Taylor. The previous episode had a pun-related Taylor Swift ad. But another man said, Thomas Hardy, har, har. He's terrible at poker. Well, what about Fred? Oh, he always loses. Oh, well, Fred, oh, then? Fred, Wilfred Owen? One player was blind drunk and angry that he kept losing. So he kept accusing everyone of having terrible plastic surgery. He squinted at one man and said, you got a BBL. Then another and said, went on a Philip Lark, isn't it? Philip Lark. When poor Thomas was dead, the pity laughs are hurting a little bit. The poor Thomas was down to his last cash. He went all in and he looked ashen. The dealer said, look, Thomas Gray. Thomas Gray. Thomas turned over his cards. There's a really good one at the end, I promise.
I'm enjoying the whole thing.
Okay. Thomas turned over his cards, stood up and yelled triumphantly, look on my works, ye mighty, this pair. Back at the party. Back at the party, everything was falling apart because someone had invited the black-eyed peas. They all have terrible manners for a royal event. Appledydap and Taboo enjoy shouting in the background, tonight's the night! Fergie insists that she's actually Princess Sarah Ferguson, and the leader, of course, has no respect for lords. Will.i.am Shakespeare's. All right, that's it. That's it. That's the one I'm proudest of. By the way, if you can spell Appledydap, you get 1,000 points.
Oh, there's a couple periods in there, right?
Yeah, it's all caps. There are a couple periods. It's APL period DE period DAP. DAP.
Oh.
Yeah. I just wonder how long it took them to come up with that.
They've been around an awfully long time, the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah, they really have. I don't hear from Appledydap and Taboo, or we don't. It's not like I have a connection
right.
to them.
I mean, Will.i.am has that like breakout star quality and seems to be fairly ingrained, you know. He seems like he's the breakout star of the group, and then Fergie, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got two games for you today.
Let's do it.
The first one I'm calling Rogan Josh. I'm gonna name a food or a diet supplement, and you tell me if it's ingredient in the Kashmiri dish Rogan Josh or part of Joe Rogan's diet.
Okay.
And note, none of these are tricks. There are no overlapping answers.
No overlapping answers. Okay, got it.
So, Josh Gondelman, are you ready to play Rogan Josh?
I am.
Okay. Number one, is this an ingredient in Rogan Josh or part of Joe Rogan's diet? Lamb.
That's Rogan Josh.
It is. Correct. Number two, glucosamine chondroitin.
Joe Rogan's diet?
That is absolutely correct. Number three, yogurt.
Yogurt. Rogan Josh.
Correct. Number four, shroom tech sport.
Joe Rogan?
Yes, that is correct. And number five, Alpha Brain.
Oh, that's definitely Joe Rogan.
Alpha. Absolutely. Five
He's
for five.
Alpha Brain. Hell yeah.
Nicely
this
done.
This is huge for me.
Oh, good. Well, hey, there's a second quiz. If you end up going 10 for 10, this will be unprecedented.
Wow. Five for five is pretty good. I go 0 for 5 on the next one. It'd still feel all right.
I think you'll do pretty well. The second game, I'm calling it I Heard a Fly Ball When I Died. I'm going to read you the title and a few lines of a poem, and you have to tell me if the writer is an athlete or a plain old poet.
Okay.
So poet or athlete. The distinction is whether or not the writer was a professional athlete. Number one, titled July 15th, 2004. No bandage can cover my scars. It's hard living a life behind invisible bars. Searching for the face of God, I'm only inspired by the poems of Nas.
Athlete.
Yes, that is J.J. Redick from his Duke days. He Sports Illustrated, it made me very angry at the time for some reason that Sports Illustrated published like 3 or 4 of his poems.
I don't remember that at all. That's really funny.
Yeah, I was in grad school at the time. So, you know, I have all these friends who are like writing poems and submitting poems and getting lots of rejections. And they're like, here's J.J. Redick and Sports Illustrated.
Yeah. And now you're once again rivals as podcasters.
Exactly. I'm breathing down his neck. He knows. Mm-hmm. And his podcast is literary, at least in the title, Old Man of the Three.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All right. Number two, a hook shot kisses the rim and hangs there helplessly, but doesn't drop. And for once, our gangly starting center boxes out his man and times his jump perfectly. It goes on from there, but I'm stopping there.
I want to say poet.
That is a poet. That is the poem Fast Break by Edward Hirsch. A great poem. It's one sentence long, basically about a fast break, as the title suggests. Really, really skillful. Number three, this poem is untitled, and I'm going to read you the entirety of it.
Okay.
Me, we.
Athlete.
Athlete, Muhammad Ali. There's this, have you seen the documentary When We Were Kings about the fight? It's really fantastic. And George Plimpton is one of the people they keep interviewing. And of course, he's talking in his untraceable accent. And he tells this great story about Muhammad Ali being asked to re-share a poem at like a commencement speech or something. And he just says, me, we. It just seems like the perfect response. Number
That's
four.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Number four, I'll give you the title of the poem. It is, as I've done every time, for some reason I forgot that I was doing that. It is maybe time to admit that Michael Jordan definitely pushed off. That one time in the 98 NBA Finals, and in praise of one man's hand on the waist of another's, and in praise of the ways we guide our ships to the shore of some brief and gilded mercy, I touch my fingers to the hips of this vast and immovable grief.
I think I've read this before. This is a poem by a poet. Is this the Hanif Atar Kib?
It is. Wow. You get a bonus point for naming the poet. That's incredible.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So technically, through nine questions, you've got 10 points. All right.
You know what? I'm out. I'm calling it.
No. The last one. We have to get to the last one.
I'm ready.
Vocations. My attorney said, we've got to get you a job. Get some structure into your life. Oh, I see. But poetry doesn't grow in concrete or in straight black and white lines. And besides that, I don't think well with a suit on.
Poet.
Kind of.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the longtime 1980s Royals reliever Dan Quisenberry?
No.
He had the most saves of any pitcher in the 1980s and is somehow not in the Hall of Fame. But he wrote two books of poems after he retired from baseball. And they're surprisingly really good.
Cool.
So I did this quiz with someone when I forgot to record, and there's a poet, and he was like, this, the last one stumped him because it's
interesting.
Like, it sounds like a poet.
Yeah.
But the way the game is going. So, well, that's it, Josh. Anything you want to say or plug?
Sure. I am on tour all over the country right now. I would love for you to come see me. I'm shooting a new special in Brooklyn in June. And before then I will be in Cincinnati area, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, Burlington, Vermont, Stamford, Connecticut, Philly, and Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And you can find all the details on my website, joshgondelman.com, or subscribe to my newsletter, or joshgondelman.substack.com. It's free. There's pep talks every Monday, and my tour dates are always in there.
Yeah, the pep talks are delightful.
Thank you.
And it's well timed for being a Monday because the whole week is ahead.
it feels nice to do on a Monday.
Yeah. Josh, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much. This is a pleasure.
Yeah. Listeners, go have a great day. Read some poems, pet some dogs, and support striking workers wherever you find them. Bye.